I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me.
Open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning, everybody. Hope you had a solid Memorial Day weekend. Remembered those that served. And we are back at it. We've got two bills, Senate Bill 418A and 1036A. I think we'll start with 1036. So let me open a work session on 1036. By the way, I'm not planning on moving or having votes on either of these bills today, but we do need to get a little more information. So I'm hoping our director from Nogami could come up. And we've had a little bit of kind of late input on this bill about the Section G and the ability or what Section G would do to things that are kind of larger irrigation district projects like the Tumalo Reservoir, and I don't know the name of the one, but I've heard about it before in this committee years earlier that had to do with a water ski lake. And I gather that that probably wasn't the intent of this section, but I'm wondering if you can tell us whether this section would just inherently somehow okay those kinds of things or allow those kinds of things by irrigation districts.
Certainly. For the record, Chair Clem, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Thank you for the promotion. I'd be happy to try to explain my understanding of how the things like the irrigation lakes and water skiing lakes fit into our permitting scheme. So until 2007, construction projects were exempt from the definition of surface mining and therefore did not require a permit from Dogami. That was changed at the request of the aggregate industry, and my understanding from talking to people that were involved with that is that the purpose was to try to level the playing field economically when construction projects were selling excess aggregate material off-site in competition with regulated aggregate mines. And so that was really their intent, was to essentially be a tax, if you will, on unregulated construction project aggregate. And
I don't think so.
The other change that was made at the same time was that Dogami was allowed to waive the reclamation plan for construction projects that were permitted. So essentially, that removes kind of the entire regulatory basis that normally is applied to an aggregate mine. In other words, there wouldn't be a reclamation plan saying you had to mine in a certain way and reclaim at a certain pace and reach a certain end state. And I think the reasoning there is that a construction project has already been through some sort of permitting, through land use, through building permits, and the reclamation is whatever the construction project, that's the end state. So there's not really any need to have the reclamation plan involved. And so what that means is that when Dogami issues a permit for a construction project, which we have done very rarely, it's essentially a fee for which you get a permit that has essentially no requirements. And so when we are viewing this in terms of how it's going to impact people building future water ski lakes in the Bend area, we're not in the business with our construction permits of telling you that you can or can't dig a reservoir. We are simply there in statute, if you are moving more than the required amount of material, to ask you to pay that fee and get that permit. The question of whether or not it's okay to build that reservoir has to be taken care of at the land use, county land use process. And that's sort of the one requirement that we have for all of our permits is we won't give you a permit unless you have proof of county land use approval. The construction, bringing construction sites into the permitting process was never really intended to be a tool to address things like appropriate land use or fish and wildlife issues or anything else. It was really meant to be this leveling of the playing field with the commercial aggregate market. And that's how we have applied it in the very few instances that we have done so far.
So one of the references in a letter that we have today that you may not have seen, talks about an irrigation district that was supposedly mining land for fill to be used on other projects that was, in their minds, just kind of routine maintenance. And then it looks like, I don't know if this is Deschutes County, but it says the county succeeded in citing and fining the district for mining without a permit and was upheld on appeal. Would that be this section, mining without a permit, or like water resources permit or somebody else permit?
Chair Clem, I think that's the KD development project, which started as an actual aggregate mine. They closed the mine, reclamation was completed, and we were done with them. Subsequently, they went in and built the water ski reservoir, and there was a complex process of back and forth with the irrigation district and the county land use process that I'm frankly not fully familiar with, but that really had nothing to do with the history of that site as a mine, because we closed them out and we were done with them. And I think it went to litigation. I think there was an appeal of the land use process, but I'm not an expert in the actual details of that dispute.
Okay. Professor Power, do you want to talk about what you've got in mind here? We had a brief conversation via text. I didn't really look at it closely till this morning, but then we had a little chance for a little conference with our friends from AOC. So can you share with us what you're thinking?
Yep, and I just emailed it over to you and AOC so they could take a look at it. So I think when we chatted, the concern was that this kind of blanket exemption for utility grading operations and maintenance doesn't have any volume limit on it, and somebody could use an exemption like this to do a fairly significant unrelated project. I was talking with some of the advocates who put testimony into the record to see if there was a fairly significant cap that maybe we could put on it that they felt comfortable with, and I think 10,000 cubic yards is what they proposed back to me, which is double the minimum threshold to trigger the surface mining permit, which still should get to, I think, most of the type of trenching utility repair work to avoid that having to trigger a surface mining permit, but would make sure that somebody's not using this for other alternative means. So I'll wait for AOC's take on that to see if it would still meet their needs, but I understand why they wanted this subsection and why it's a streamlined process that doesn't need your input too.
Somehow these kind of things will still be able to.
Is there a question?
Sure.
I have a very hard time hearing your voice.
There
yep. So with the addition of, say, a 10,000 cubic yard cap on this, would you have any comments on that as meeting the original needs of this subsection?
Certainly, Chair Clem, Representative Power. A 10,000 yard cap as opposed to a 5,000 yard cap would somewhat reduce the number of sites where the permit was required. It would not change the nature of the permit that we issue for construction projects, i.e., no considerations about wildlife protection or noise or dust or anything else. It's not hard to move 10,000 cubic yards of material. So it's not, that's not like an order of magnitude change that's going to reduce, the number of sites that are involved by a factor of 10. It might reduce them by a factor of 2, perhaps. And so I guess the real question is, what kind of regulation do you want to see from Dogami on construction sites, and what is the purpose of that regulation? Because that seems to me to be the real question here is, rather than which sites get included, is what are we trying to do with this? Because my impression of it that I've described to you is that it's a really very narrow attempt at leveling the playing field for the aggregate industry.
So I know that we had conversation in, I think it was my land use committee previously, about this one project that people are worried about. But if I remember right, it's water resources that's really the decider on these water ski lakes and whether they truly are irrigation projects or whether they're just amenities for homeowners called irrigation districts. And so I feel like there's a little bit of misguided angst about your permitting process if it's the one that's going to allow or not allow. I understand that it may have a role, but I think in the end, and they're not here, I'd haul them up here and talk to them about it, but the one that they've got a photo of, I remember hearing about this, and the issue was it was an irrigation district project, but it didn't have any pipes that connected to the irrigation district. And so if you fill it up with water, and the whole theory was it's going to help these farmers during bad times with water, there probably should be some way to get it out of the irrigation canal, and there wasn't. And because the guys who built it were home developers who it was viewed as maybe a backhanded way to get a lake front property by calling it an irrigation pond, and then there was no way to ever get any water out of it. And I think they finally said, well, that'll come later. But I think all that was a water resources complaint, and I think water resources shut them down eventually. And I know there's very powerful lawyers on both sides because I remember these fancy people coming in to talk to me from both sides. So I'm going to see if there's any more questions on this and then hold it over and let AOC react to these proposed amendments, this cap. But I also may try and get water resources in to see if people who are worried about somehow these ski lakes proliferating are possibly thinking about a different agency that they ought to be more concerned about if they're the ones allowing them, because I'm fairly certain that your process would not either approve or stop these in particular. And then I'll come over here. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to add a little clarification for my request, if this is largely about ski lakes, I'm not a water skier, so I don't have an appreciation nor an understanding. If this is what a lot of this conversation is surrounding, then I need to know more information, such as, is a ski lake bad? Well, if permits are obtained under false pretense, then we have a whole nother issue. So I personally need some more information on this to understand if this is about ski lakes and if that's good or bad, and if this is the only mechanism to control that.
Representative Power.
Sure. Thanks. I'm curious to help provide, a little bit more information on the background of this. What is the expertise that your staff provides to current projects that do trigger the need for a permit? Can you tell me a little bit more about the function embedded in the current statute and how it currently works?
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time not hearing you, but following where you're going with the question.
So we're proposing to create an exemption in state law for a host of different type of activities that currently trigger the need for a permit. Can you walk me through what expertise and professional work that your staff provides on these types of projects under it currently stands?
Certainly. Chair Clem, Representative Power, sorry for the confusion there, but I think I understand what you're asking. So the majority of sites that we permit are aggregate mines, and we are in the business of giving them permits that are appropriately conditioned to ensure that the site is reclaimed at the end of the mining period. We are not in the business generally of saying you can or can't mine at a particular place. That happens through the county land use process. So if you come to us with a credible reclamation plan, a security bond, and land use approval, you will get a permit eventually. Along the way, we review that permit and the reclamation plan for many technical aspects, including slope stability, impacts on groundwater, floodplain and wetland issues, and we circulate our permit applications to every other state agency that's interested and tribal nations as well to get their input on things like fish and wildlife issues, cultural resources, et cetera. And if appropriate, we include conditions in the permit that address the concerns that we hear from somebody like ODFW. And we also require that if there are other agencies' permits, like a DSL permit for operations below the ordinary high water line, that they get that permit from that other agency as well before we will issue our permit. But at the end of the day, we are in the business of facilitating mining and ensuring reclamation. So we aren't making a decision that you can or cannot mine at this site, as long as you can show us that you can properly reclaim it.
Vice Chair McLean?
Actually, Vice Chair Springer asked my question.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll give us a little time to think about this until Thursday. And I do know that, generally speaking, the issue about these water ski lakes is whether they serve a purpose for the irrigation district and the farmers. And if they do, I personally don't actually have any problem with people deciding to ski on them while they're still up. I just want them to also be available for watering needs and not be designed to create recreation only with no purpose. Otherwise, let's call them what they are, which is a recreational lake, and figure out a way to get a permit for that and not call it an irrigation lake. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of these letters deal with impacts on groundwater, and you just stated that Dagami does look at impacts on groundwater. Does DEQ also do the same thing with the same level of expertise?
Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, for groundwater issues, Dagami does have authority to ensure that there's no impacts on the groundwater resources, and typically this is in a case where a mine has to dewater. And so we will design a system with them and monitor it to make sure that they're recharging the aquifer with the water that they dewater out of the pit. For the water quality issues, that is regulated by DEQ, but we are the agent for DEQ for the regulation of both process water discharge and stormwater discharge from mine sites. We have an agreement with DEQ to do that regulation at the mine sites, because we already are out there doing inspections for other purposes. So that is also covered with all of our mine sites, is the water quality issue.
So what I heard you say is DEQ then uses your agency then to determine these things. Is that what you said? To determine groundwater leaching or affecting the aquifer?
We administer the permits that allow and control stormwater discharge and the management of on-site process water. So the water that they're using to wash the gravel is muddy, and they can't discharge it, and they have to either treat it or somehow reinfiltrate it into the ground.
So I'm thinking of a landfill, you know, a little different, you know, than what you're used to in quarries, but I'm thinking of a landfill that we throw everything into, and then it has that potential to leach.
And that is regulated entirely by DEQ through... Yes.
Good.
Okay, so I think, thank you, sir. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 1036A. Let me open up a work session on Senate Bill 418A. And we've got a hot off the presses amendment that came in late Thursday afternoon after most of us were gone, I think. And now I've lost its proponent to tell us about it. One moment.
So it would be the A7.
Yeah. Mr. Henniger, can you come ask? Is yours A7?
Yes, sir.
Okay, can you come tell us about this? Oh, maybe while you're doing, there was another amendment. Where's Counselor? I forgot what number they were.
I just had one.
There were A4s. We're not going to entertain those. This was our bend soils bill that we already had once before. And it went over to rules to be amended down to just Bend, I thought, but apparently it can't get out of rules now. Not sure why exactly, but it also had another life over in my Metolius bill and is not making into there either. And so I've talked with the proponents, and rather than load this bill up with one that already can't get through the Senate committee, we decided to just let it go. Can't get out of rules, can't get out of the Senate. We know we can't get out of the Senate committee going into the Metolius bill. We don't know what would happen on concurrence, but we just decided to let it go. So forget A4s, and let's hear about A7s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here on the Dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 418.
Let me just pause for 1 second. For committee members like Representative Brock Smith, who have not seen my late session shenanigans, this would be us listening to what would be a stuff, not a gut and stuff. This would go along with the base bill. And then the process, it would, if we decide to vote on it, see if it passes here, see if it passes the House floor, then goes back for concurrence to the Senate. And the committee it came out of was Senate Environment and Natural Resources.
No, it was the Business Committee.
Business and Labor Committee.
Yeah.
No, Senate Environment and Natural Resources. It's Senator Byers' bill, but it came out of Senator Dembrough's committee.
Okay.
Unanimously and across the floor unanimously.
Okay. The purpose of the A7s, Mr. Chair, is, as those of you who deal with the land use world understand, we have a 20-year buildable land supply requirement in state statute that was put in place in 1995. And what the 20-year land supply requirement does, it's in ORS 197-296, it requires, at this point, Metro to ensure that there is a supply of available land within the urban growth boundary to satisfy 20 years worth of residential development. It's an important issue and obviously important for the development community to ensure, and it, frankly, important for everyone to ensure that there is enough land available for residential development within the Portland metropolitan area. Obviously, the amount of land has a lot to do with the housing prices, and of course, it also has a lot to do, and I don't think you've discussed this much in your committee, with the density requirements. The problem that we have currently is that there is land within the metro urban growth boundary that was brought in 2002 for the purpose of satisfying the 20-year buildable land requirements that unfortunately lacks the services necessary to enable the property to actually develop. So while the land is in the boundary, it's counted as part of the 20-year of the supply for the 20-year residential land requirements. It's unable to actually satisfy those requirements because there is insufficient services. It lacks water, and the area we're talking about is the Damascus area. The Damascus issue has been an issue that's been kicked around in this building for quite some time. Metro brought in Damascus in 2002. The people out there formed a city as a result of their incorporation and inclusion in the urban growth boundary. Of course, then they never could get along, and ultimately the legislature ended up passing legislation that allowed a vote to disincorporate, and the city of Damascus became, I believe, the first city maybe ever, but for quite a period of time, to actually incorporate and then disincorporate. And it was all the result of the 2002 decision to bring them into the boundary. That there are significant areas out there, in fact, well over 3,000 acres of land out there that Metro includes as part of their 20-year residential land supply that have no services, no infrastructure. They have no sewer, they have no water, they have no roads, and they don't have any way at this point to actually provide those services. Now, that was done in 2002. We're now 15 years later into a 20-year buildable land supply, and those areas aren't any closer to being available for urban-level development than they were in 2002 when they were brought in. So what we have is Metro including these areas as part of their land supply, when we all know that within the 20-year time frame, those properties are not going to be available for urban level development. The statute 197-295 defines buildable lands. It defines buildable lands as lands that are suitable, available, and necessary for residential development. I believe that the acreage in Damascus that Metro counts towards their buildable land supply is not available. It wasn't available in 2002. It's not going to be available by 2022. So essentially, it was brought in as part of the 20-year land supply, but it can't serve its intended purpose. And when that happens, then we end up with an artificial shortage. What this bill does, or what these, excuse me, what these amendments do, is they provide that if Metro brings in land and it's been inside the boundary and is counted as part of their 20-year land supply for at least 15 years, and there is no way in the next 5 years that it can develop at an urban density that's equal to the lowest residential density in the neighboring city, then Metro can't count it as part of the 20-year land supply. It doesn't require Metro to do anything. It just simply says that the next time that Metro reviews their land supply, they can't count those lands that really aren't available for development. That's all the bill does. It doesn't tell Metro how to conduct its needs analysis. It doesn't tell Metro how much density that they can expect in their dealings with the city. It doesn't change the designation on any of the properties that are involved. It doesn't change the rural reserve or urban reserve designations that Metro just finished up that are on their way ultimately down to LCDC that we've talked about in earlier meetings. And it applies only to land inside the urban growth boundary. So it's a small fix, but we think an important fix to guarantee or to better ensure that property owners in the metro region have an understanding that that the 20-year land supply means land that at some point in that 20 years will actually have the services necessary to enable it to develop. Doesn't mean that it will develop in that 20 years, but it means that the services will be there to enable it to develop.
And we'll ask Metro to come up and talk here in a minute. Questions for Dave? Vice Chair McClain.
Well, I don't even know what to ask. This is, you know, your analysis of the situation. And, you know, I've read all the buildable lands inventories for this particular area. And I actually believe right now that this is duplication of what Metro is already doing, which is, you know, you're talking about Damascus and acreage that didn't come in to the city of Damascus. You're right. The city of Damascus was unincorporated because they were in financial problems, and they got legal advice that says you need to start over again, so disincorporate and then decide what you want to do. We have Happy Valley out there and also Gresham that are working diligently, starting to urbanize many of those acres to Happy Valley. Gresham is looking specifically at being able to service some of those acres that Damascus might have taken up. And we still have time for them to look for a plan on how to do that infrastructure that you're talking about. So why and how did you analyze this piece of work that you just gave us today?
Mr. Chair, Representative McClain, if you look at the language of the amendment, if it turns out that there is actually the ability to provide those services within the 5 years, then this language wouldn't apply. So we know that Happy Valley has a line. We talked, Mr. Chandler and I talked to the mayor of Happy Valley the other day. They have mapped area to which they'll go east, to which they'll extend and annex and provide services. That area, unfortunately, excludes a significant amount of land that Metro, that's within the boundary that Metro counts, although as I believe Metro will tell you, they heavily discount, which is great, but unfortunately, zero if it's not going to develop, you can heavily discount it, but it needs to be heavily discounted to zero, except for those areas that Happy Valley will actually include, annex and serve. And, of course, using the language of the amendment, that wouldn't apply. Not as familiar with what Gresham is trying to do, but again, if Gresham has a plan in place to where they can, where there's adequate financial resources to provide the services right now, and that'll happen within the next 5 years, so they meet their 20-year deadline, then by terms of this, of these amendments, that those areas would not be, Metro would be able to count those areas as part of the land supply.
I think I'll wait till after Metro.
Metro,
talks,
okay. Yeah. No further questions right at this moment. Okay, thank you, Dave. And
Mr. Chair, can I add one?
Sure.
Mr. Chandler and Mr. Jillians and I met with Senator Beyer, and Senator Beyer said he was fine with these amendments.
Okay. Thanks. Come on up. Tell us how you discount Damascus area lands.
Thanks. Good morning, Andy Shaw with Metro. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought we would pull up a slideshow we did actually for you when we brought House Bill 2095 earlier this session, because I think a lot of the information in a couple of those slides is instructive for this discussion. We would urge you not to add this language in the dash sevens to the bill. We don't think this is needed. It actually does force the hand of Metro in trying to conduct our forecast by essentially, you know, putting blinders on our face about certain lands, rather than doing what we're supposed to do under the law, which is look forward 20 years and make the best prediction we can about what's going to happen on the various lands we have. So these are the UGB expansions. The grayish light color is what was in the original 1979 Metro boundary. The dark gray areas are what have been added to the boundary over time. So you can see, yes, Damascus is a very large expansion on the eastern side. When we do our forecast right now, we do a very comprehensive two-year process involving population, demographers, economists, developers, all kinds of folks every step of the way to figure out how many folks are coming to the region, how many jobs are we going to have, and then we look at lot by lot around the region what can happen on the lands within the boundary. What is legal, what is possible under zoning, and what is actually going to happen under the market. But first, we take out all kinds of lands that have conflicts, that are too steep, that have wetland problems, or that we don't think for other reasons are going to get developed in that 20-year period. What we're left with at the end is a map of buildable lands. So this is land available inside the urban growth boundary currently, and also in the blue, lands that are in the urban reserves or will be in the urban reserves when we're complete with that process later this month, that are buildable lands. That's what's in the inventory we think has a possibility of getting developed in the next 20 years. And our job under current statute is to every 6 years look forward for that 20-year period and do the best forecast that we possibly can. This last round, because of all the uncertainty around Damascus, when we conducted the last urban growth boundary and made our decision, we knew that there was a vote coming up on disincorporation. And, of course, we had very closely worked with Damascus City and followed the process there, attempting to simply get a comprehensive plan in place. They never had an adopted comprehensive plan, which is the first thing we look to in forecasting what growth is going to occur, because that sets the amount of density, that sets the kind of housing, et cetera, for the area. So Damascus has always been a challenging place to make forecasts around. And I would say back in 2002, no one could have predicted what was going to happen out in Damascus with the creation of a city, a series of ballot measures that were put on by citizen groups that hampered the city's ability to actually govern itself, raise taxes. There had to be a vote on any tax or fee that would have been proposed. There had to be a vote on the comprehensive plan. Those measures really hobbled that city's ability to govern, which is why, in the end, the legislature helped the citizens there disincorporate the city. As was discussed earlier, what's now happening is Happy Valley has a plan to annex lands to its east into the western portion of Damascus. Happy Valley is one of the most capable cities of overseeing and planning for development. So we actually believe that that western portion of Damascus will develop quite readily over the next period of time. We agree that the eastern portion of Damascus is going to take a lot longer to develop, primarily because it requires a water pump station that's very expensive to get sewer and water over the hills there. And like other areas in the region, it requires infrastructure investment before development can actually occur. You may remember when we brought House Bill 2095 to the committee last in February, we preceded that with a task force, 14 mayors, two county chairs, home builders, 1,000 friends, involved in a broader discussion about how could we do a better job of looking at the best places to expand the urban growth boundary into. There were two parts of that discussion that we didn't share with you. One was what to do about Damascus. The other was what became House Bill 2095, proposing mid-cycle urban growth boundary expansions. The group grappled with the question of Damascus. We talked about, could we take Damascus out of the urban growth boundary? And that would then potentially create a need for more land. We quickly informed folks that we had already deeply discounted our expectations for what was going to occur in Damascus. We took out half of the expected development in that area over the next 20 years in our 2015 urban growth boundary decision. So we're already counting zero growth in that area that is being discussed in this bill. We don't need either a heavy hand or any help in doing the forecast in a way that realistically predicts what's going to happen in Damascus or in other parts of the region. If we go back to, just to remind you, this is a slide that shows where housing is actually being built in our region. And our last forecast predicted very strong growth in existing city centers, and that's exactly what we've seen over the period of time since the 2015 urban growth boundary expansion. At the same time, the reason we brought you House Bill 2095 was to give us a little more flexibility to work with cities that are ready to make expansions and oversee the annexation, the funding of the pipes and roads and other infrastructure that's required in those areas. That, we think, is the best path forward to making smart UGB expansions and managing growth in our area. We don't think the legislature stepping in and making a decision about this eastern portion of Damascus helps our region manage that growth. I think I shared with some folks that the city of Gresham, in the discussion we had with our task force, began to make some suggestions that they might be interested in looking to their south towards that eastern part of Damascus as a way for them to grow into the future. The last thing I'll just say is 20 years is a really long time, and we take our job predicting growth very seriously. We involve a lot of folks in the process, and we would just encourage you to let us do that the way we do it now. In 2018 is our next opportunity to look at where we think growth in the next 20 years is going to occur and how it's going to occur. We've already begun collaborating with the same kinds of folks that I mentioned before to prepare for that process. So again, we'd encourage you not to adopt the -7 amendments.
Vice Chair McClain.
One thing that you said there, Andy, I think is real important. When Mr. Honeycutt was up here, he made it sound like we hadn't, you know, re-looked at that growth report for 15, 20 years. And as you point out, we're doing that every 6 years. And so it's not the 15-year look back that we have discounted from. It's the 2015 look.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And that's a maybe a difference of opinion about how we should do this. The way that this amendment was described earlier was almost as if when you add the land 20 years later something hadn't happened, then you had to look at it different going forward. That's not how we conduct our forecast. We're trying to take the best knowledge about population growth, about job growth, about the current market, about where people are investing, what kind of public investments will spur what kind of public investments might spur private investments to understand where growth is really going to occur in reality. And so pretending that certain lands exist or don't exist because of what's happened over the last 15 years doesn't make sense. The other point I would make is this: the idea that there's not a plan for infrastructure over the next 5 years would push us to a different kind of process. We're looking at the development potential over 20 years every time we do that forecast. So we take into account where are cities with their plans, where are cities with their list of projects they plan to fund. If somehow the urban growth boundary process became what could be developed in the next 5 years, that would be a very, very different discussion than what we're directed to do under current law. I'll remind you, when you heard House Bill 2095 earlier, you had the mayor of Hillsborough come in, and they'd done a study of what happened after land was added to the urban growth boundary, and they found it took an average 6 years before cities could get that land developed. And the city of Hillsborough also is a very capable city. We added land there in 2010. They are just now at the point of being able to build homes, and we hope there'll be homes built there this summer and into next year. We're excited about that development occurring in that area, but it's a showcase for the challenge of getting lands online. So if it takes 6 years to get developed and you put a five-year clock in a bill like this, that just doesn't match up again with the reality of how development occurs in our region. The last thing I would say is there are a lot of lands that have been added to the urban growth boundary that don't have infrastructure. That is a point I think we've come back to the legislature again and again to promote to you, that we need help funding the infrastructure to help get those lands developed. We've added around 26,000 acres of land to the urban growth boundary over the last two decades or so. Maybe 10% of that land has been developed in that time, largely because of annexation, which the legislature helped address in the last session, and the lack of funding for infrastructure. So that's the problem, not our planning or forecasting process.
Okay. Representative Brock Smith.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Can you go back to the other slide that showed the that one? And we'll just call it green, the available land inside the UGB. What's the zoning of that land? What's the majority of that land?
So I believe this map is all housing. I don't think it is showing employment lands. But it's going to vary. Actually, I take that back, because I see land up along the Columbia River that I know is employment lands. So it could be employment or housing. Some of it's going to be mixed-use zoning. Some of it's going to be single-family. It's going to vary depending on the location.
I'm just wondering, is that farmland? Is that what's on that now?
Again, it's going to vary. If you look at the big square area south of the O in Hillsborough, that's a lot of farmland. I think that's South Hillsborough. And that's an area that's going to be developed with mixed-use housing, single-family housing, a variety of different types of development. If you go out towards Damascus, there's a lot of development from before land use laws were put in place that's at a more of a rural residential level. And that's one of the challenges that we've had out there with planning for the future of that area. So it really varies depending on where you are on the map. But the cities develop and adopt a comprehensive plan. They adopt the zoning for those areas under the regulatory, under the framework plan that Metro has and state law.
I'm just wondering, because I know how sacred farmland is in the state, that there seems to be, whenever I'm up visiting my brother in Portland, lots of open farmland spaces, and that could correspond with a lot of these spaces that you have in the map. Do you get any pushback from any folks in the community with regards to taking farmland and turning it into homes?
Well, we have a saying that the two things Oregonians hate are density and sprawl, and we certainly don't like sprawling out onto farmland. So back to the urban and rural reserves process, we in Hillsborough and some other jurisdictions approached the legislature back in 2007 to ask for authority to establish urban and rural reserves for the purpose of identifying how we would grow and yet protect the valuable farmland around our region. And the compromise there, because it was a compromise, was to allow some farmland to become developed while keeping the boundary relatively tight around our region. So there are indeed areas in particular on the west side of the region that are high-value farmland that are in urban reserves, and then 270,000 acres of farmland that's in rural reserve. and therefore protected. There are some areas to the east of Damascus that are also identified as prime farmland, but also along Highway 26. So the compromise in the end was finding some good places to grow. Some are hilly and challenged, some are flat and farmland, but at the same time then protecting hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland from future development over the next 50 years.
So once they get brought into the UGB, the underlying zoning expectation changes. And I don't know that the zoning changes overnight from EFU, but it changes once a city wants it to change quite easily. It's not like what you've been dealing with in the golf course land. It's pretty easy to get the EFU off once it's in the UGB. But at some point, you do have to figure out who's going to put the infrastructure out there, the developer, the city, who. And so until that gets figured out, you have big chunks of area that are expected to develop, but you know, nobody's got a project, so they don't bother to get the zone changed until such time as they have a project, probably. If you drive along 26, you'll see an area that's all in the UGB from the 2016 short session that still looks like farmland, but given another couple of years and it won't at all. It'll be totally different north of the airport there. Okay, anything else on this dash 7 for now? Okay, then back on the underlying bill, Ellen, could you join us? I'm sorry to surprise you, but I remember, and it's just been so long now, I remember you all raised a concern or raised an issue that there was an amendment that was added late. Because, you know, we see these bills come over unanimously out of committee, unanimous across the floor, and then we hear about concerns like, what's going on? And I thought you said one of the amendments that got added to it was kind of late. And can you remind us what your concern is with it?
Sure, yeah. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Ellen Miller with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. There was the Dash 2 amendment, which is still up on OLIS, that was adopted over on the Senate side. And what that did was it prohibited a party from objecting on a UGB expansion based on any of the previous work tasks. So our concern was that it didn't meet the intent of the bill to speed up the process for cities because it could potentially motivate parties to object every step along the way because they wouldn't have the opportunity at the end. So it's just a concern that we had. But again, it was something that was adopted on the Senate side.
So would would the concern be that the bill, because it's voluntary, meaning a city has to request this, the bill just may not be nearly as useful because some city will try it, they'll realize that this has now caused even more complaints, and then no one will ever use this?
That is a concern. The other Chair Clem, members of the committee, the other concern is that that appeals process would go through the Court of Appeals and therefore require the state to defend the appeal. So it's both a concern in that it would take this, it possibly delays the time for the cities. So yes, one might assume that the cities may choose not to use this process if that was the case. Mm-hmm. But also that the appeal process would go through the Court of Appeals versus going through LUBA and therefore fall on the agency and the state to defend that.
So you may have a fiscal on this that you didn't know about before if you did have to defend it?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, no. That would only happen if it was appealed, so it wouldn't actually be reflected in the fiscal.
Vice Chair McClain.
The other item that you talked about on that dash two that gave me concern is that since they've taken the four steps and they've made every one of them a single action, that means that if, because it took longer, because somebody was able to go to the courts after each section, if you have something that changes in section one or step one, like the buildable land inventory, which, you know, they take that and they take it to the court, and then it takes long enough that by the time you get to step two, you find something in the buildable lands inventory that needs to be updated, can you update it if it's a single action?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, I do believe, and I would have to follow up with you on this, but I do believe that the city would retain the right to be able to go back and to adjust those previous work tasks.
So my point, Mr. Chair, is that because of the length of having a court case in between each step, there is a likelihood that by the time they get done with that one step, they may have to go back and do work in that step one anyway, because now it's outdated or doesn't have some necessary new information. So it doesn't get the city any closer because they have to go back and do step one anyway, again. So it looks so inefficient is what causes me grief.
Okay. Any other questions about the underlying bill? Okay. Might revisit with Senator Beyer a little bit on this. I know he came to see that he wants his bill, but we'll talk this over. Okay. Let me carry over the work session on Senate Bill 418. I've already carried over the other bill. And anything else for the good of the order? Sorry, I can't get us out again on Thursday, but we got to come in at least to deal with these two. And with that, we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you. I